across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Hope everything's good with you. Keep the emails coming. Thank you very much indeed for your communications and your involvement in my Facebook page, the official Facebook page of The Unexplained with Howard Hughes, and of course this show that's been running here now for more than 16 years. And as I've mentioned before, I am off the radio at the moment, but will return to TV and radio very soon. More information about all of that, when I get it, I'll put it on my Facebook page and you can read all about it there. And thank you very much. A lot of support for that. Of course, it's something completely new for me. I'm not a big fan of being seen, never have been. And I've had people over the years, you know, people who are in television. One news reader who's particularly well known in the UK. Good looking guy he is. So obviously he's going to be on the TV and be very favoured for that. And he said to me, this is about 10 years ago now, we met on the train. And he said, oh, hello, Howard, nice to see you. We'd worked together in radio. He said, why did you never do TV? He said, you know, you look okay for it. You'd have been fine. And I said, well, it was never really my thing. Well, now at this stage of my life, it appears that I'm going to be appearing before the cameras. And it is scary, of course it is, because it's a new medium. I understand radio upside down and inside out. I've done everything from disc jockeying to break major news stories like the death of Diana and 9/11 and all of those things reported from Ground Zero. So I've done talk shows and news and music shows, all that sort of stuff. By and large, radio doesn't scare me. I think TV, because it's uncharted territory, does. So the show's going to change a bit. And, you know, as soon as I know, you will know how it's going to change. But it will have the tingle and what's that word, frisson, of having live guests. So the people who are appearing, you will know that I haven't recorded some of them a few hours or a couple of days before. Everything that you see, at the moment anyway, that's the plan, is going to be live. And that's what the people who run the station want. So that's what we're going to do. And, you know, we'll see how it goes. It's a new medium. And as somebody pointed out to me, and as I've mentioned before, isn't it interesting that when I was looking for a domain for the Unexplained podcast, the only one that I could find and buy was the unexplained.tv, even though, you know, it was never a TV show. Now, crucially, some people have been asking questions about that. The soundtrack to the TV show will still be heard, just like the radio show, in all the same places. It will just be available as something that you can see in more places, you know, big places. But more about that, as I say, when we when we know, when I know. Now, the guest on this edition of The Unexplained is Mike Ricksecker. He's been on this show before. He is a man who has done many things. He's the author of A Walk in the Shadows, A Complete Guide to Shadow People, which we've talked with him about before. The historic paranormal books Ghosts of Maryland, Ghosts and Legends of Oklahoma, Campfire Tales, Midwest Ghost Story and Case Files, and the Encounters with the Paranormal series. He's appeared on loads of TV shows, on loads of different stations, including Animal Planet, Travel Channel, The Bio Channel, and ABC News, and also on major radio shows, including Coast to Coast in the US. So he has been there, done it, and what do we say? Bought the T-shirt and sent the postcard. Do you say that in America? I don't know, but we say that here. I've bought the T-shirt and sent the postcard, which means that you've done everything. Mike Ricksecker is that person. We're going to talk about the Alaska Triangle and a few other interesting bits of strangeness and paranormality with Mike Ricksecker in the US. Thank you for your emails. Please keep those emails coming. If your email requires a response, then please put it in the email that you require a reply. If not, please know that I see every email as it comes in. And as I've said, until I'm green or blue in the face, first thing that I do at the beginning of every day, and sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night because I'm not a great sleeper these days. There's a lot to worry about. I turn on the phone, I empower the email, and I take a look and see what you've been saying. Guest suggestions, always gratefully received. If you know of ways to contact those people, that's going to help as well, because all of this is done on an absolute shoestring, which is half the fun of doing it. And I'm still doing it just about after 16 years, so there. Okay, that's all the housekeeping taken care of. Thank you very much. When you get in touch, tell me who you are, where you are, and how you use the show, because I like to know, okay? Right, let's get to America. Mike Ricksecker returns. Mike, thank you very much for coming back on the show.
Absolutely, Howard. Thank you for having me back. I really appreciate it.
So how has life been for you since we last spoke? You know, you're normally pretty busy, so I guess you've been even more busy.
Yeah, definitely been pretty busy. A lot has been going on with my writing. I have a new book out, Alaska's Mysterious Triangle, that came out back in October. And I've been filming for a number of television shows since then, both concerning my work with shadow entities and also the Alaska Triangle. And you know, I have the new learning platform that I've put out, the Connected Universe Portal. So yeah, definitely been very busy.
The Connected Universe Portal.
Yeah, it's an online learning platform. So we have weekly classes out there talking about all kinds of different esoteric topics, whether it's, you know, we're talking about standing stones, we might be talking hauntings. We just did an episode on supernatural DNA. So the idea that, you know, some of the DNA inherent within us, you know, we have, you know, these different traits handed down from our ancestors or even past lives. So we cover a lot of different topics.
So the idea that some of the things that we consider to be paranormal abilities or paranormal sensitivity, you think might actually be within us?
Yeah, actually within the DNA itself, that it's passed down from our ancestors to us. And, you know, we kind of talk about that, like, you know, well, we inherited something from, you know, a specific ancestor, or, you know, that idea that, you know, sometimes these abilities skip generations. Yeah, it's actually encoded within the DNA. So it's not surprising that they're actually finding this within science itself.
Isn't that interesting? Because as we've seen, I'm sure you have too, I certainly have, you know, when I speak to people who've experienced, I don't know, alien abduction or paranormal phenomena of various kinds, or they might have a psychic ability. When you talk to them a bit, I would say easily 50% of those people, possibly north of that, they say, well, funnily enough, my dad did this, or, you know, somebody connected through a, you know, through a DNA connection did this. You know, in my case, my grandfather, my dad's dad, my dad was quite sensitive. And, you know, it was only later in life that he told me that my late grandfather, his dad, used to read teacups for people. You know, when times were tough and, you know, money was tight, he used to read the teacups for them.
Oh, fascinating.
So I think these things can sometimes run in families and in connections that are familiarly linked, I think is the way of putting it. That's a fascinating thing to talk about. Now, we are here to talk about the Alaskan Triangle, which a lot of people are not going to have heard of, but I think it makes sense that there are triangles in other places than Bermuda. We know that there's one in China that people talk about. There are a number of these things. How well is the Alaskan Triangle known?
Well, it's becoming more well known because of the television show that came out a couple years ago, The Alaska Triangle. I've had the pleasure of being a part of four of those episodes, which is fantastic. We've had two seasons completed so far. Fingers crossed we get a third. And yeah, this is in an area of the world that one of the names has been Alaska's Bermuda Triangle, but most people are just calling it the Alaska Triangle now. You know, very similar type of properties where strange and unusual things happen. Like you said, there are several of these all over the world. It's not just Bermuda. You know, and yet, Triangle outside Japan and, you know, Lake Michigan.
There are, as we say, there are a number of places. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, there have been recent reports of one in China. I need to investigate that. Now, look, I'm very interested in UFOs and ufology. And I just took a look at Alaska when it comes to UFOs, because there have been a number of sightings and things that have happened over and around Alaska. But I was disappointed to read that in terms of ufology, I know that's not specifically what we're going to be talking about here, but in terms of ufology, in a ranking of U.S. states when it comes to ufological sightings, Alaska is only 45th.
Go figure. And I don't know where, and I don't know where those statistics come from, because there actually is quite a bit of UFO activity in Alaska. One of the most famous cases in the United States was actually Japanese Airlines flight in 1986.
The crew, weren't they? They were, I'm sorry, I'm jumping in all over you here, but the crew were not exactly encouraged to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, there was an investigation. FAA got involved, and because the media kept hounding them, hey, you know, there were all these reports. And basically what happened was, is you had this, essentially it was a flying saucer. It was almost like a globe with kind of a disc around it sort of thing. And it kept following this flight for quite some time. And, you know, they have the radio transcripts, the chatter between the flight and then the air traffic control. A United Airlines flight got involved. The military was involved with their radar. And, you know, so you had all of these different organizations that had actually witnessed this thing to one degree or another. So the FAA got involved and were trying to run an investigation, but then entered the CIA. And once the CIA got involved, they squashed it. But there are a lot of interested parties in this, like Reagan. It was during the Reagan administration, so there was a scientific team from the Reagan administration that had gotten involved. But yeah, the CIA basically put the kibosh on it.
But it's still a fascinating case, and it's good that we're talking about it some more now. I think, from memory, the pilot was suspended for a while, I think. Weren't the crew suspended for a while, or am I misremembering that?
That was a different case.
Okay.
This was more of just monitoring this thing following right. The airplane.
So this was not the JAL case. All right. Now, the Alaska Triangle, I've been looking up a few details about this, and I'm just getting my piece of paper. It says, the borders of the Alaska Triangle connect Anchorage and Juneau in the south to Utqiagvik. Is that how you say that? Utqiagvik?
Utqiagvik. Yeah, Utqiagvik.
Utqiagvik.
I know, it's hard to pronounce. It used
on
to
the
be,
north coast.
Yeah, it used to be known as Barrow, which is much easier to pronounce. But they gave it back its old Inuit name, Utqiagvik, which is all the way, it's the northernmost point of Alaska.
Well, what this definition tells me, that what is surprising about that particular area is the sheer number of people who go missing.
Yes, absolutely. Over 16,000 since 1988 have gone missing. And sure, you know, several of those are, you know, just very natural. People get lost in the woods. Some, you know, people get kidnapped. Some people just don't want to be found. But it's an excessive number of people that have gone missing.
How does that compare with other states?
On average, if you look at the percentage, it's high. Now, other states are more highly populated, like New York, California, what have you, which would still be 16,000 would still be a lot for states like those. But considering how sparsely populated Alaska is, percentage wise, it's a very, very high number. And some of these reports that you have of people going missing are it happens right in front of people. It's a pretty famous case from I think it was 2010 or 2011. It was during a marathon. It was called the Mount Marathon race in Seward, and Michael LeMaitre, he runs up the mountain, never comes back down. You know, this is in the middle of a race, never comes back down, is never found. There's no body, nothing. You know, they scoured the entire area. He was, to this day, he's never been found. Nobody knows what happened to him, right in the middle of a race.
Now, some people might say, well, look, this is an area that has snow and bears. What do you expect?
Well, and like I said, in some cases are going to be such where, you know, maybe there was an animal attack, or maybe somebody went hiking in the woods and they're just lost.
But, you know, you'd find their boots, or you'd find bloody footprints, or you'd find something.
And remnants of many of them are found, and those are very sad stories. But others are just, they just go, and you have the missing airplanes, you know, where just all of a sudden, poof, they're gone. There's no wreckage, you know, they're just completely off the map.
We've talked on this show before about this. I might even have talked with you about this. This is this bizarre case in 1972 that started people talking about the Alaska Triangle. A small private plane carrying a U.S. politician, Hale Boggs, he was the House Majority Leader back then, vanished in that area completely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, House Majority Leader Hale Boggs and also Alaska Representative Nick Begich. They were on a flight from Anchorage to Juneau, heading through the Portage Pass, and you know, another one just completely just disappeared into thin air. And that was because of how high profile it was. You know, thousands of people went out to search and investigate, thousands of hours of manpower. They got spy planes involved. To this day, nothing has ever been found. It just completely disappeared.
So are people continuing to, I mean, it's 50 years now, but that shouldn't be a bar to continuing to investigate a thing. Are people still looking into this?
Well, what's interesting is there was an individual who came forward some years back. I think it was about 8 years ago now. And he had some information for law enforcement in Alaska through, he was involved with some nefarious people back in the day. And he said he had some information about some various open cases from long ago, from decades ago. And one of those cases happened to be this Boggs Begich disappearance. And according to him, he had been instructed, and it was a job that he was running, he was paid to do it, to put this package on that particular airplane. He didn't know what the package was. You know, it was one of those no questions asked, you know, here's your money, go deliver that, job is done. Years later, he was told, well, that package actually had explosives on it. So then, of course, comes the question, well, did that plane explode? Was that a bomb that was planted on the plane?
And why?
Hale Boggs. Yeah, well, Hale Boggs had some, he had ruffled some feathers. He dissented against the Warren Commission, which was the investigation into the JFK assassination. He had some enemies, some political enemies, so that could have been why. Now, even though this individual came forward with this information, they did not reopen the investigation. And according to law enforcement up there, they said, well, you know, if there had been an explosion, there would have been wreckage scattered all over the place, and we never found any wreckage. And even through the years, you know, since that time, there are other planes that have gone down in the Portage Pass, and they never came across any wreckage from the Hale Boggs disappearance. So they've never reopened it. But it does lead one to question, well, why not? You know, why not at least take a peek?
I hate something being left literally, well, not hanging in the air, but hanging in the air metaphorically. Not to have an answer about that, and especially for his family. That must have been very, very hard pill to swallow.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, extremely hard for the families. They each had children. People probably remember Cokie Roberts. That was Hale Boggs' daughter. Hmm. Nick Begich, his son, Nick Begich Jr., he's a doctor. He's done a lot of work in the field. He has books out on HARP and the conspiracies behind HARP as well. So not only... Yeah, okay, sure. So, yes, very hard.
Now, look, Alaska is... It's an unusual area, obviously, because it is so sparsely populated. It must be a wonderful, fresh place to go to because of all of that expanse of land, the fact that the temperatures are really low, there are few people. So I would imagine it's quite a refreshing and, in some ways, exciting place to go. But it is mysterious with it, isn't it? And one of the things that is mysterious about it is the fact that it is adjoining or abutting what is now Russia, but was the Soviet Union. There's always that aspect to it, isn't it? There must be some military significance.
There is. Yes, it's definitely, Alaska is definitely very, very beautiful. I spent 3 years there as a member of the United States Air Force back in the early to mid 90s. I would say this about Alaska: amazing place to go and visit. Yes, fresh air, beautiful scenery, all that. It's tough to live up there. Especially if you're not used to the wintertime with such dismal lighting. You know, I was in a secure facility all day, so if I didn't go outside for lunch, I never saw the sun that day. So days like that are hard, but I do encourage people to go up there, visit, tour the area. It's very, very beautiful, majestic. The air you breathe up there is just so much fresher. It's amazing. But you are correct. It's right there by Russia. And when I was stationed up there, my term started in 1992, and there was an earthquake that went off. I was in the dormitories at the time, and it was a 6.5 earthquake, but it sounded like a bomb went off, just boom, and then all of a sudden everything started rumbling. And my immediate thought wasn't, earthquake at that time. I had not experienced earthquakes to that point. And you know, it's one of those where it's like, well, it sounds like an explosion just went off. We are right near the former USSR, you know, which just got dismantled a couple of years beforehand. So you know, there could be anything going on. So it was very disconcerting, especially at that time.
What about military experiments that are done there? Since there's such an expanse of land, I would imagine it would be a great place to secretly try out all kinds of technologies, whether they be flying technologies, whether they be technologies that use radio waves or microwaves or whatever. You know, there is a place, surely, where America must have been doing these things. And, you know, when you have situations like that, you have situations where people can misinterpret what is being experimented with and call it paranormality. What do you know about that?
Well, yeah, there's certainly just the remoteness of the area. It's very, very expansive. So, you know, you could get away with hiding quite a bit up there. And that's, you know, where you start hearing about, you know, secret underground bases, you know, even if it's secret UFO bases, but you know, certainly military installations that are hidden under the ground. You know, people flying around in their you know, on their little Cessna airplanes, just to take a day trip. You know, they look down on the ground and they see these old, you know, runways that are no longer being used and roads that are abandoned going off to nowhere. You know, what were those used for? What were they doing down there? And, you know, very little knowledge as to what those activities may have been. People talk about the Black Pyramid, that there was some government involvement in whatever was going on with that particular installation, or even Mount Hayes. So, you know, I wasn't directly involved in any of those secret. I mean, I was in a secure facility, but you know, people knew what we were doing down there, and it was, it was command and control systems. There's a little bunker that I knew about where we stored some equipment and things like that. But yeah, people will ask me, you know, did you know about any of these secret installations or...
Well, in particular, did you know about HAARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program? And you talked about Mr. Begich Jr. and his work on that. Now, if that started, which apparently it did in 1993... Then
yeah, I was up
there
when it started. I was up there when they installed it. Yeah, I wasn't involved with it. That HAARP is in Gakona, so it was a ways away from me. But we were definitely familiar with that. And you know, of course, the rumors started way back then. Okay, what are they doing? You know, with HAARP. You know, the definition for it is basically to test the ionosphere and. Where people got really concerned about HAARP, of course, there's all the different ideas about changing the weather or mind control and things like that, and that really got poignant when they admitted, well, yeah, we've created an artificial aurora in the sky. So once it gets to that point where they're actually creating artificial aerial phenomena, that's where people really got concerned about it. I was very secretive back in the day, so I didn't know too many details while I was stationed up there. But the information that's come out since then has been, fascinating and borderline terrifying with some of the different things that they could possibly do, especially Begich's work on the way that the low frequency can affect the human body. Now, I've postulated in my book very briefly because, I don't have anything to really back it up, but just, because I come from a technology background, I've had a 30-year career in the IT industry, and just the way we've been able to miniaturize everything over that time. You know, think about a computer 30 years ago. They were very large and bulky. Well, now take HAARP technology, and it would have been big and bulky back then. You're talking acres and acres of a facility. Have they been able to miniaturize it since then? Or is there maybe a somebody driving around in a van with HAARP technology in it that's able to do these different things that are postulated about it, whether it's weather change or mind control or something like that? That's always a possibility.
It is. So when we're talking about the unexplained, there's a great phrase. Somebody should make a show out of it. And alas, yeah. You know, there are all kinds of aspects to this. And I know
I'll
that
say this, that's exactly what I'm doing tomorrow.
Really?
It is.
Well, there we are.
Off to New York.
Synchronicity, I think. So, you know, all kinds of things here. You've done a lot of research, and we'll talk in a moment about your second edition of the book about shadow people. But you say that there is a specific connection to the shadow person phenomenon and Alaska. What is that?
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, shadow phenomena, it can really happen anywhere. But there are locations around the world that have more of that, Earth energy, that magnetism that's welling up from the magnetic core of our planet. The Alaska Triangle is one of those areas. So you hear, you know, a lot more stories about, you know, whether it's haunting, supernatural activity, shadow activity. The aforementioned secure facility that I worked in, we had significant shadow activity that occurred within that facility. Now, we couldn't be very open about what was going on because, you know, you start talking too much, you're going to find yourself down at mental health, and you don't want that. It was your security clearance, and that's that. So, you know, it was in whispers, really, that it was expressed, like, hey, did you see that? Yeah, I saw that. And there was this kind of an urban legend that started being formulated about the building. Some guys were saying, well, yeah, the building, it was the Alaskan Command Building. The building was once a hospital, and where our, you know, facilities were, had been the morgue, and where our rack room was, and, you know, where we had the patch panels and multiplexers and all that stuff that supposedly had been where they had the coolers for the morgue. Well, when I was researching my book, because of course I want the facts to back up that story, doing the research on the building, and that was never the case. The building was actually built for command. So then the question becomes, okay, well, if it wasn't a hospital and these aren't, you know, like the souls or spirits of the, the people that had passed through the morgue, then what are these shadow entities that we kept seeing all over the place, especially in the back office areas? That's where my work from A Walk in the Shadows comes into play, and, you know, I postulate some different ideas. And one of them, I think that it may be, is we may have been experiencing some sort of time slip back there. You know, especially, you know, you have the electromagnetism from the Alaska Triangle there, but then you also had all of our equipment back there as well. So was that creating such an environment that the frequency of that environment was periodically tuning into the same frequency as other points in time, and we were getting glimpses of that, perhaps personnel from years ago or even ourselves in the future. So,
but that sounds almost like the Montauk Project light, doesn't it?
It kind of does, yes. We'd have to investigate more on that, but of course they would never let you do an investigation like that in a secure facility in the Alaska Command Building. But so, you know, we have ideas that we're working with.
Okay, when you talk about that and shadow people there, a lot of people write to me about their experiences with what they think are shadow people. When they appeared to you in that military facility or to people who experienced those things, in what way did they interact? What was the dynamic?
Yeah, it was, I'll say this, they didn't really interact with us. So the fact that they didn't interact would probably lead somebody in the paranormal field to say, well, it's probably a residual haunt. And this is why I went more down, you know, it's a time slip. What would happen is, like, I'd be, you know, sitting at my desk. If I wasn't, you know, out on the floor, you know, administrating one of the systems, then I'd be out of my desk doing something else. And there'd be times that all of a sudden it would get very, very just like dark, heavy, very creepy. And it's like, okay, what is going on? You know, you felt like something was about to happen. And then you kind of turn and you look, and there's this shadow going down the hall toward like the back corner of the office. Or, you know, sometimes you'd actually see them, you know, dart into the server room, or there is even this little room in the back that had these old printers in it that, you know, lights are always turned off back there, and they seem to like that area, and they dart in back there. So they didn't, you know, it's not like we had a conversation with one, or they, you know, tapped you on the shoulder or anything like that. They just kind of, you know, kind of stealthily moved about, but you would feel them, and everything would just kind of get dark and heavy for a moment.
And did you get the sense that whatever it was aware of you?
Yeah, that's a good question. They may have. It's hard to determine whether they did or not. We were certainly aware of them. And as far as if they were aware of us, very, very hard to know. Because when you saw them, it was either very fast or it just kind of would slink around the corner. You know, it just, the interactions were not very lengthy.
I mean, it sounds like you're sort of turning a page or partially opening a portal or something.
Very well could have been. Again, with that electromagnetism there, that could very well be what was happening.
And the people commanding that facility, were they made aware of what was going on?
Well, and that's what I was saying before. You don't want to talk about it too much because you don't want to find yourself down at mental health. I mean, like with my supervisor, we were having a conversation when I was first transferred over there. And I had been working there for a couple of weeks, and he had been at another assignment. So I had already seen some of the activity. When he finally showed up and we had our initial conversation, we're sitting there at his desk, and I noticed something pass by the doorway, something shadowy in nature. And I was looking at it, just kind of like froze in place for a second. And he says to me, just very simply, "Yeah, that happens here." And that was it. He acknowledged it. But that was going to be it.
Yeah,
and that was as far really up the chain as it would go. You know, it's not like the, you know, the acting general there in the building was going to acknowledge it, but we did.
Okay. In your discussions of the Alaska Triangle, I know that you also touch on what we would call cryptozoological creatures. What do you know about those?
Yeah, there are a lot of different types of cryptids up there, whether you're talking, you know, Bigfoot, Sasquatch. They have a being up there very similar that they call the Hairy Man. There's the Kushtaka, which is the Otter Man, which is kind of very similar in nature to almost like maybe Skinwalkers or Wendigo type stories. You have the Lake Iliamna Sea Monster, which they kind of call the Loch Ness Monster of Alaska.
Oh.
And then you go ahead.
No, I was just going, ho.
Okay. And then you also have the Thunderbird legends, which I've taken a particular interest in because we, you know, we talk about, you know, some of these different missing airplanes like we had earlier. And, you know, the idea has been postulated that some of these airplanes may have been, you know, they may have passed through a portal in time. And when we filmed the Alaska Triangle television show, we had Bruce Gernon on, who, you know, has some very interesting experiences through the Bermuda Triangle, where he actually passed through what he called an electronic fog. And it was a tunnel that he passed through. And then all of a sudden, boom, you know, city of Miami was under him. He had basically traveled 100 miles in 3 minutes. So he had experienced some sort of vortex or portal, some, you know, time dilation absolutely happened. So if this sort of thing does occur in the air in these triangle areas up in the Alaska Triangle, when some of these planes have gone missing, and if they pass through a portal, the question then becomes, where do they go? Well, if they pass through that portal into another place in time, now Bruce Gernon, he jumped ahead in time, but some may be going backwards in time. So if an airplane passes through a portal and shows up in the same location 500 years in the past, just to throw out a number, what would the native indigenous people at that time, 500 years ago, think about an airplane passing overhead?
Well, they would, you know, think it's connected very loud to a god or a deity.
Right, a god, a deity, or their legends of the Thunderbirds. So I think some of the Thunderbird legends that have been passed down over time may actually be some of these missing airplanes.
UFOs and ETs. Now, we talked about the Japan Airlines case. What do you know about UFO cases over Alaska? I know that MUFON document them all over the United States and all over the world. You know, I wonder how much activity there, you know, in recent years there's been there.
Yeah, people report UFO activity there all the time. MUFON has done a fantastic job of chronicling a lot of those particular cases. You know, talking about some of the missing airplane cases, you know, like I did, there's a famous one from 1950, is a Douglas Skymaster airplane that just out of nowhere just completely disappeared. It's a perfectly fine day, and all of a sudden they lost contact, was never found again, no wreckage, nothing. But just preceding that, 2 days beforehand, there had been a UFO sighting near Kodiak, Alaska, which is just south of Anchorage. And then a couple of days after the fact, there was a UFO sighting that was near Elmendorf Air Force Base, which is where the plane originated from. So you tend to find sometimes these UFO sightings around these different missing airplane cases.
How interesting. And that, again, can only help us to pose questions, because we don't have answers, you know, wish we did, as to where the planes that disappear might go, and, you know, whether they're going forward in time or, as you said, back in time, and they might be reported as a god or a deity or a Thunderbird phenomenon. But if they're going forward in time, then are they being escorted there by things that we call UFOs? We don't know.
Yeah, that's a great question. We don't know. That's why we keep asking the questions and trying to dig into the information to see if we can answer some of those. And usually what happens is we might answer one question and then we have 20 more that then get asked.
Now, since Alaska is such a sparsely populated place, is it big for ghosts and hauntings?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's certainly a lot of hauntings, especially at the old hotels that pocket Alaska. People don't realize, because it's such a sparsely populated state, that there's, you know, tourism is big up there. But it's not just that. You know, people have been transient throughout Alaska for a long, long time, whether it's, you know, been military. There's been gold rushes up throughout Alaska, mining operations. So you have a lot of people that are in and out of the area all the time. And so you end up with these different hotels that have been there for a long time. The Gold Rush era in the Klondike is particularly interesting because, you know, people don't realize, you know, Klondike, that's Canada, but people don't realize that the people who would travel up there would actually start in Seattle or maybe Vancouver and travel up the coast of Alaska, debark in, you know, some of these cities along the coastline, and then trek up into the Klondike. Well, that's where all of these hotels sprang up at, and it was really like the Wild West, but up north. So you had bordellos and saloons and all these different types of things that, in kind of the same actions that would happen in the Wild West, you would find in Alaska, where you have these bar fights and shootings there's a prevalent story that you find in all these different hotels where, a couple, you know, man and a wife or a man and a girlfriend, arrived there in Alaska. The wife stayed behind in the hotel. The man went off to go strike it rich. And then all of a sudden, you know, he's gone for a long time. The woman runs out of money, you know, finds a job at the bordello. He comes back, finds out she's become a prostitute, murders her. And then all of a sudden her ghost is there. You find that story through a lot of these different, haunted locations. And whether or not that's just an urban legend, the buildings are still very, very haunted. There's still a lot of activity happening in these buildings.
And because it's so cold up there, now here's a dumb point for you. Maybe it isn't. And those buildings would have been wooden. I'm guessing that more of those are preserved, are they?
Not all of them were wooden. Like the historic Anchorage Hotel in downtown Anchorage, that one's actually made of brick. But a number of them are wooden as well. Unfortunately, you know, some of the older buildings were destroyed in the Great Alaskan Earthquake in 1964. But those that have survived have a very rich history about them.
Mexico, South America, of course, Egypt here closer to where I am, all have very strong connections to ancient civilizations. And I know that you've done research as to who might have been in Alaska before us.
Yeah, Alaska has an interesting history when it comes to the ancients. Now, we do know for a fact that peoples did cross over the Bering Land Bridge about 18,000 years ago and populated the area. And what's interesting about their stories are, and you find this within the native Inuit culture and their legends that they've passed down, and they talk about giants that also crossed over from Siberia. They were these larger peoples. So these are like some of the other cryptid stories that you hear about the giants that had crossed over. And I find it interesting that they say that they specifically came from Siberia, because you were now finding evidence of like the Denisovans, which were a larger type humanoid people from that area. So, okay, was it the Denisovans that had crossed over? But another story that came over along with them was that these giants had bred with the regular native population and created this, you know, unusual type of offspring. And so you read the story and you're like, this is very, very similar to the story of the Nephilim out of the Bible or the Book of Enoch, where they talk about the interbreeding and, you know, creating these different, you know, races of humans. And it makes you scratch your head. Like, how in the world did this story end up in Alaska? But there it is. So it does have a distinct connection back to the ancient world that, you know, people just really aren't aware of, but there it is.
And more research is being done that suggests that not only were ancient people more connected than we ever gave them credit for, but also they were more able. They had, although we wouldn't recognize a lot of the technologies, but they were able to do things that we wouldn't have thought they could.
Oh, yeah. Throughout the world, you see a lot of that. You know, how in the world were some of these structures ever built when we barely have the technology today to move some of these, you know, massive stone blocks? And but yet they were able to do it. So, you know, kind of the, you know, traditional, you know, historians or archaeologists kind of scoff at the idea when we say, well, there was, you know, high technology long ago with the ancients. But the thing is, we're not talking computers and cell phones and things like that. We're talking about, you know, different methods of being able to construct, or, you know, you see, hey, some of these ancient cultures actually did have indoor plumbing and things like that. And then, you know, suddenly the knowledge got lost. But yeah, how in the world did they build some of these different structures? And they had more knowledge of consciousness, of how to, you know, enter some of these different states of being, you know, maybe healing methods, things like that. We find that at our different ancient sites of power, like, you know, Stonehenge, the pyramids, things like that. And, you know, I do believe that there were connections from Alaska back to the ancient world when, you know, you talk about Egypt and these other locations. I believe that there are also connections back to Antarctica. And there's so much, you know, under the ice in Antarctica that we have yet to discover. I think we're going to be very, very surprised when we start seeing some of that come forth. And I think we're going to find an extremely ancient culture back then. I think one of the things they're looking for is the actual technology that was used to, you know, do some of these different things they were able to. And it's frozen there under the ice. I think they're looking for that.
You've updated, we mentioned this, your Shadow People book. What's new?
Yeah, I've included about 50 more pages within that book since the first edition came out. I released 40 more pages of it last year. And then just recently here, when I finally recorded the audiobook for the second edition, there's an additional 10 pages that I snuck in there. So some of the Alaska information is in there, but also, you know, I included some additional information about, you know, there's some doppelganger stories that have come forth where, you know, people wondering about, okay, what is the, you know, are some of these shadow entities that we see doppelgangers? Gee. There's more information in there about, you know, like Alvar K. Bender and his experience with shadow entities, which he believed were extraterrestrials. You know, I've updated a lot of information on you know, history of shadow entities and things of this nature. So you know, just to kind of, you know, make it a much richer read, a little bit more information about some of these different entities that we see that may possibly be these shadow entities.
So when you talk about shadow people possibly being doppelgangers, does that mean that if you sometimes ask the question, what are these things? Well, the answer might be you.
Exactly. It's, there's some really fascinating stories when it comes to doppelgangers. People think the traditional doppelganger, evil twin, that sort of thing. And I don't really think there's like the evil twins, like some other entity that's mimicking you. I don't believe it's that at all. Because, like, you know, the famous poet Goethe, you know, he has this fascinating story about when he was a younger man. He's traveling down a road headed to a particular city in Germany. And coming down the other side of the road was this man in this, you know, strange gray suit. You know, and he just noticed it distinctly. That's a very interesting suit that he's wearing. And as the man came closer, he suddenly disappeared. Well, years later, of course, he saw that, thought that was very unusual. Years later, he's headed down that road in the opposite direction and realizes, wait a second, I'm wearing that gray suit. I was that guy. I saw myself. So it's an interesting type of doppelganger story. There's a one particular young man just recently here, I caught wind of this story, in which when he was a child, he was entering the kitchen of his house, and in the kitchen near the table was this dark hooded figure. Scared him to death because he was a young child and took off out of there, you know, dark shadowy figure. Well, years later, when he's a bit older, he's at the kitchen table, he's making a sandwich, he's wearing a hoodie, and he notices in the doorway there's this shadowy silhouette of a young child, and he realizes in this moment, wait a second, when I was a child, I saw myself older in my hoodie, but it came off as like this dark shadowy form, and vice versa. When he was older, he saw himself again. So yeah, I think a lot of these stories of these, you know, doppelganger type images are really people just experiencing them themselves from another point in time.
So if we think the time maybe is a series of dimensions of, you know, it's almost like the tracks on an LP record. We've talked about that analogy before. And occasionally you cross over into another one. Actually, you might be imperfectly seeing a vision of yourself in that location. But because you're not seeing it perfectly, you might be experiencing yourself as an imprint, as a shadow, as some kind of pale reflection of you.
Yeah, exactly. Some of these images that we're getting are really just ourselves, or, you know, another person who had, you know, it's interesting. You know, some of these ghost sightings that we're seeing, you know, a woman in a Victorian dress or what have you, you know, we're looking at them saying, we're getting an image from the past. And the person suddenly turns and looks at you as if you're the ghost. They're actually getting a vision of the future. The way I view time is, you know, time is all concurrent, past, present, future, happening at the same time. And I like to think of it as a stack of photographs. I have something I call stack time theory, using the analogy of the stack of photographs. And for whatever reason, we don't exactly know the catalyst just yet. But for whatever reason, two of those moments, two of those photos in the stack, their frequency are resonating at just the right frequency where we get an image of each, and they kind of bleed over into each other. And it's not a perfect image. It might come off as a shadow. It might come off as an apparition. But we get a glimpse of it just for a moment, and then it disappears on us.
Now, you've got a docu-series, The Shadow Dimension, about this. In which you do research. I'm not sure that this is a phenomenon that you can research. I mean, you can't go to a place and expect the phenomenon to materialize, can you? You can't get them to appear to order, can you?
Yeah, you can't make it happen on demand. That's the problem with this type of research is, you know, when you're conducting scientific research, you know, you are going to a location, you're going to try to make something happen. You need a control object, and the control, like if you're just trying to say, okay, you know, the experiment that I want to conduct is, you know, whether it's shadow or this building's haunted or whatever, you would need, the control object would then have to be a place that doesn't have shadow activity, that's not haunted. Well, how would you know?
How would you know? And I guess you'd have to try and get your subject into a state where they might experience this. And a lot of people tell me that they experience these things when they're in that state of sleep paralysis.
Yeah, that happens too. And, you know, sleep paralysis is a natural biological phenomenon that can happen. Does not happen all the time, but it can. And so, yes, with the shadow dimension, the idea behind that was to go to locations that had experienced this shadow activity, where it was known to occur there. We can't make it happen on demand, but let's at least go. Let's talk to people who have had the experiences there. We'll run an investigation, whether it happens or not, fine. But let's see what other type of activity we might get there. You know, one of the ideas is, with the portal activity from the vortex energy, we wanted to pick locations that had that going on, like the Conjuring House in Harrisville, Rhode Island, or Mineral Springs Hotel in Alton, Illinois, that are known to have that type of energy there. So, you know, let's research that. Whether we get the shadow activity to occur again, we can't make it happen on demand, but let's at least research it out.
And you went to the Perron family house, the Conjuring House.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that's the first couple episodes of The Shadow Dimension, where we went there. And I caught an interesting photograph, which looks like what I call interdimensional phasing in a room, in the room that has reported that shadow activity. Now, I had Carl Johnson with me, who in 1973 saw the rolling black smoke come out of that room. Very good friends with Andrea Perron. She's a part of the docuseries as well, where she talks about experiencing the rolling black smoke out of there as well. And actually, in that room myself, while I was filming, I was interviewing Keith Johnson, and I started getting very, very lightheaded in that room. I had to hand Keith the camera, and I had to sit down for a little bit. And it was a little while later, when I was taking photographs, that I caught. It's a very unusual photograph. Everything in the foreground is very clear. It's crystal clear. But then there's an interior window on a wall, because they added onto the house over the years. And that's where Andrea's former room was, where this black smoke came out of. And everything from there and onward is shifted to the right, so much so that the window in the other room, it's an exterior window that looks outside, which you could not see through the wall because there's a wall in the way before you get to the doorway. That whole window that you could not see was actually shifted into the picture from out behind the wall, and you could see it through the doorway, against what's a chalkboard on the wall in the room beyond. It's really bizarre. How in the world is a window that we could not see suddenly in the photograph? And again, everything in the foreground is clear. So
had that place been remodeled?
Not in some time.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm just wondering whether you were seeing an imprint of a previous version of that. Maybe there'd been some restoration improvement work, whatever.
Right. No, I get what you're saying. Now, I think what I captured on that in that photograph was an image of the energy there. What's very, very fascinating about that house is directly below that room, two stories, it's the basement, but they call that room down there the well room, because there is an actual open well down in that room, still has water in it. And then the room itself is made of limestone and capped with granite blocks, which granite is 55% quartz. It's a very, very good conductor of electricity. This is something that the ancient Egyptians would use in their building and would also use for piezoelectric properties. So you have basically this little power plant that's down there. And while the entire house and the grounds of the house have experienced all kinds of activity, it seems like a lot of it is concentrated straight up from that well room. Gee. So we were talking before. Hmm. Yeah. We were talking before about time slips, about somebody seeing the ghost and the ghost seeing them as if they're the ghost. That happened right in the room above it, which is the parlor, where Andrea and her mother, Carolyn, one day from the parlor looking into the dining room, they saw these, it was a 18th century family sitting down having dinner, and two of the gentlemen turned and looked at Carolyn and Andrea, and one said to the other gentleman, would you look at that? Yeah. So that happened right directly above the well room. So
isn't that interesting? So you've got a possible theory for that. I mean, Andrea Perron has been on this show just before Christmas and told that exact story. Great. It is an astonishing, fascinating, amazing, and chilling story. But the idea that that whole house might be some kind of power plant or battery is interesting, isn't it?
It is. It is. And Andrea likes to call it a portal cleverly disguised as a farmhouse. And I completely agree with her. And I think that room is the little power plant for it.
Anything else that I haven't asked you that I should have asked you about the shadow people?
And we could talk all day about shadow entities. I believe some are extraterrestrials. You're kind of talking about extraterrestrials earlier. I think some of them are actually ETs. It's a fascinating story with Albert K. Bender. I think I started mentioning him earlier, where he had formulated the International Flying Saucer Bureau back in 1952 during the big UFO flap that year. And the organization grew up big, where within a year's time, it went internationally. They had offices in the UK and Australia. And of course, back in 1952, you didn't have the internet. Long distance calls were very expensive. And yet there he is, within a year, this thing has blown up huge. And then all of a sudden, boom, he just ended the entire organization, stopped printing their newsletter, said, we're done. And so people wondered why. Why did he do this? They speculated, well, maybe it was the Men in Black. Well, he finally, years later, he published a book where he did say, yes, the Men in Black, but let me tell you the story. And what he said is that he had gone up into his bedroom one day, and through the wall materialized these three dark, shadowy beings wearing hats. They had these glowing eyes, and they smelled of sulfur. And they told him he needed to stop all of his research that he was doing with the International Flying Saucer Bureau. So I hear this story, and I'm immediately thinking, well, this is a paranormal story. These are the shadow people, the hat man that we always talk about in paranormal circles. Albert K. Bender said, well, these were actually extraterrestrials, and they were harvesting resources down in Antarctica and wanted him to stop digging into what they were doing until they had left. They had a 15-year mission to harvest these resources. Other people hear the story and they say, well, these were the Men in Black. So it's almost like, depending on which lens you're viewing some of these stories through, that you will have your conclusion, whether it's shadow entities, ETs, Men in Black. Sometimes they're almost one and the same.
But the shadow people, as reported, are never really reported as being benign, are they? They're always reported as being either mysterious or sinister or both.
Actually, I kind of disagree with that. I mean, there are stories of course, sinister, nefarious entities. I've actually found that most are benign. Most are just watching and observing. Now, that may be very disconcerting for somebody. Of course, it's very creepy. Somebody's intruded into your space. But if you actually think about what they're doing, they're not doing anything but standing there and watching you. And they're, whatever they're doing for gathering information, is not necessarily nefarious. Some of these are actually benevolent, where they actually do help people. And I have several stories about those. So it's a mix. Some is, and I'm going to say this very simplistically, it's like people. Some are good, some are bad. So some shadow people are good, some shadow people are bad. Some humans are good, some humans are bad. It depends on the particular agenda of the shadow. Some are just human spirits that can't fully manifest. So it might be, somebody's Aunt Jane. Yeah, I've seen rolling black smoke morph into the apparition of a little girl. Mm. And she's not evil and nasty and nefarious. So it just depends on the shadow.
But it seems this phenomenon is at the confluence, is at the borderline territory of so many of the things that we don't understand and we can't really explain. Ghosts, Men in Black, UFOs, all of these things all seem to verge on the shadow people phenomenon. So maybe actually they are a manifestation of one thing. We talk about ghosts and UFOs and ETs and all of the rest of it, but maybe there is one phenomenon here. Maybe it's one thing, we just don't fully understand what the one thing is.
Well, I think what we don't understand is the method in which they enter into our domain and into our plane of existence. I think there are several different species, several different types of entities that are interacting with us, entering our world, and a lot of times, in order to do that, I believe they have to use the same methodology. So whatever that energy transfer is that they have to use to come from their plane of existence into ours, I believe that's where it starts coming off looking similar. So if it's some sort of energy transfer, they end up looking like a shadow. Well, you have a variety of different shadows where it's, full human figure. Sometimes they're wearing the hats. Sometimes they're very, very translucent. You kind of barely see them, but then boom, all of a sudden they dart across the room. Some of these don't even form up into a figure where they're, just a mist, and it's kind of, very vaporous in form. So you have a lot of these different, styles and varieties of different entities. And then we talk about the ghosts, some of them you see a full apparition. Well, there's the woman, or there's the little girl. And sometimes it's, you just see a body part, or you just might see, almost like a white smoky vaporous sort of thing. And so is it just that the energy transfer that they're utilizing makes them look, black or white, whichever the case, people tend to fear what they don't understand. So they see a shadowy form, or they see a ghost, and they, they get scared about it. And it might just be a time slip. It might just be, somebody's grandmother that's, peeking in at the house, or seeing if, their granddaughter's there, or whatever. Some of these, people know how to astral project. So it could be an astral projection of somebody that's right here on the planet. Maybe they're a grandmother who lives 500 miles away from her family and knows how to astral project and wants to peek in on the family and see how things are going. And, how does that energy look on the other side of the projection, from her body to the room? Do we see a shimmer person? Because people talk about like seeing a shimmer man sort of thing.
Now, because this is so insubstantial, it's hard to classify. It sounds like it's extremely hard to research. What more research can you do into this?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of my research is it's very anecdotal. Where I'm collecting all these different stories from people. When we do paranormal investigations, of course, we have the different devices as meters, and we, take note of, okay, what are the environmental factors going on here? A lot of times we notice that, things like electrical storms will, amp up that activity, and suddenly we're seeing more things. So, all those things play into it as well. What's going on with the ground? Is there seismic activity happening? We were talking Alaska Triangle earlier. There's a lot of volcanic activity there, a lot of many earthquakes, a lot of seismic activity. So that plays into it as well. Mm-hmm. Even, auroral activity. We have these solar flares, that pound the Earth, and there are locations on the Earth where the magnetic protection is thinner, like, again, Alaska. And that's why we see the aurora borealis. But it also creates an environment that's highly magnetized, and you see more of this activity. So, we try to take all of those factors into account when we perform this research. And then you have, some of these, bigger, scientific, studies that are being done, like the ANITA project and the Ice Cube project down in Antarctica, where they're, finding these neutrinos that are running, backwards that shouldn't be. And so now you have these different ideas like, wait a second, did we just detect a parallel universe running backwards in time? I mean, this is like the scientific community that's saying these things now, which rolls right into, our studies in the more metaphysical, supernatural side.
Mike, it's good to talk with you again. If people want to read about your work, books, TV series, all the rest of it, where would they go?
Yeah, you can find me, MikeRicksecker.com. You can find links to all of my books out there, as well as the Shadow Dimension docuseries. Please give that a watch. It's running free on Tubi TV right now, which is fantastic. And also ConnectedUniversePortal.com. That is my online learning platform. So please come join me there.
Mike, good to talk with you again. We've covered an awful lot of ground, not all of it in Alaska. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Howard. Thank you very much.
The return to the unexplained of Mike Ricksecker. I'm sure he'll be back again too. Your thoughts about him and all the guests here on The Unexplained, gratefully received. All you got to do is go to my website, theunexplained.tv, follow the link, and you can send me an email from there. More great guests in the pipeline here at the home of The Unexplained. So until next we meet, my name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained Online, and please, whatever you do, stay safe, stay calm, and above all, please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.